They stayed in the cellar until they were sure the man had gone. Then they crawled out, leaned against the wooden wall, giggling. After a while, Elay stretched out on the concrete floor and stared up at the ceiling. Oscar touched her foot.
"Are you tired?"
"Yes, tired."
Oscar pulled his knife out of the sheath, looked at it. It was heavy, beautiful. He carefully pressed his pointed finger against the tip, then removed it. A small red dot. He pressed again, harder. When he took his finger away, a pearl-shaped drop of blood came out. But this wasn't the way to do it.
"Elay, do you want to do something?"
She was still staring up at the ceiling.
"What? Do you want to enter into a pact with me?"
"Yes." If she had asked him how, maybe he would have told her what he was thinking before he did it, but she simply said yes. She wanted to do it, whatever it was. Oscar swallowed hard, gripped the knife so the edge was resting against the palm of his hand, shut his eyes, and pulled the blade out of his hand. A stinging, smarting pain. He caught his breath. "Did I do this?" He opened his eyes, opened his hand. Yes, a thin trickle of blood was revealed in his palm. The blood appeared slowly, not as he had thought, in a thin line, but as a string of pearls that he stared at with fascination as they merged into a thicker, uneven mass. Elay lifted her head.
"What are you doing?"
Oscar was still holding his hand in front of his face, staring at it.
"It's easy, Elay. It wasn't even..."
He held his bleeding hand towards her. Her eyes widened. She shook her head violently while she crawled backwards away from his hand.
"No, Oscar."
"What is it?"
"Oscar, no!
It almost doesn't hurt at all."
Elay stopped backing up, staring at his hand while she kept shaking her head. Oscar was holding the knife by the blade in his other hand, held it out to her handle first.
"You only have to prick yourself in a finger or something. Then we'll mix our blood, and then we have our pact."
Elay did not take the knife. Oscar put it down on the floor so he could catch a drop of blood that fell from his wound.
"Come on, don't you want to?"
"Oscar, we can't. You would be infected. You..."
"It doesn't feel like that, it..."
A ghost flew into Elay's face, distorting it into something so different from the girl he knew that he completely forgot about catching the blood that dripped from his hand. She now looked like the monster they had recently pretended that she was, and Oscar jumped back while the pain in his hand intensified.
"Elay, what..."
She sat up, pulled her legs under her, crouched on all fours, and stared straight at his bleeding hand. Took a step closer, stopped, clenched her teeth, and got out a gruff,
"Leave!"
Tears of fear welled up in Oscar's eyes.
"Elay, stop it! Stop playing! Stop it!"
Elay crawled a bit closer, stopped again. She forced her body to contort itself so her head was lowered to the ground and screamed,
"Go or you'll die!"
Oscar got up, took a few steps back. His feet hit against the bag of bottles. It fell over with a clinking sound. He flattened himself against the wall while Elay crawled over to the little smear of blood that had fallen from his hand. Another bottle fell over and broke against the concrete floor while Oscar stood pressed against the wall and stared at Elay, who stretched out her tongue and licked the dirty concrete, whisked her tongue around on the place where blood had fallen. A bottle clinked softly and stopped moving. Elay licked and licked the floor. When she lifted her face to him, there was a grey smear of dirt on the tip of her nose.
"Go. Please. Leave."
Then the ghost flew into her face again, but before it had time to take over, she got up and ran down the corridor, opened the door to her stairwell, and disappeared. Oscar stood there with the damaged hand tightly wrapped. Blood was starting to well out around the edges. He opened it, looked at the cut. It had gone deeper than he had intended, but it wasn't dangerous, he thought. Some blood was already starting to congeal. He looked at the now pale splotch on the floor. Then he gingerly licked a little of the blood on his palm, spat it out. Nightlights. Tomorrow they would operate on his mouth and throat, probably in the hopes that something would come out. His tongue was still there. He could move it around in the sealed cavity of his mouth, tickle his upper jaw with it. Maybe he would be able to talk again, even though his lips were gone. But he did not intend to talk again. A woman, he didn't know if she was from the police or a nurse, sat in the corner a few meters away, reading a book and keeping an eye on him. They allot so much of their resources when a nobody decides his life is over. He realized that he was valuable, that he meant a lot to them. Probably they were digging around in old records right now, cases they hoped to be able to solve with him as the perpetrator. A policeman had been in yesterday to take his fingerprints. He had not resisted. It didn't matter. It was possible that the fingerprints would link him to the murders in both Vaxur and Nürnberg. He tried to remember how he had proceeded there, if he had left fingerprints or other traces. Probably. The only thing that worried him was that by way of these events, people could track down Elay. People. They had put notes in his letterbox, threatened him. Someone who worked at the post office and who lived in the area had tipped off the other neighbours about what kind of mail, what kind of videos he received. It took about a month before he was fired from his job at the school. You couldn't have someone like that working with children. He had walked away willingly, even though he could probably have brought it up with the union. He hadn't actually done anything at the school. He wasn't that stupid. The campaign against him had increased in strength, and finally one night someone had thrown a firebomb through his living room window. He had escaped out onto the lawn in only his underpants, stood there and watched his life burn to the ground. The crime investigation dragged on in time, and therefore he didn't get the insurance money. With his meagre savings he had taken the train, rented a room in Vaxur. That's where he started working on trying to die. He drank himself down to the level where he used whatever was at hand. Acco Acne Solution, Tea Red. He stole wine mix and yeast in paint stores and drank everything before it was ready. He was outside as much as possible. In some way, he wanted the people to see him die, day by day. In his drunken stupor, he became careless, fondled young boys, got beaten up, ended up at the police station. Once he sat in jail for 3 days and puked his guts out, was released, kept drinking. One evening, when Hawken was sitting on a bench next to a playground with a bottle of half-yeasted wine in a plastic bag, Elay came and sat down beside him. In his drunkenness, Hawken had almost immediately put a hand on Elay's thigh. Elay had let it stay there, taken Hawken's head between her hands, turned it towards her and said, "You are going to be with me." Hawken had mumbled something about how he couldn't afford such a beauty right now, but when his finances allowed. Elay had moved his hand from her thigh, leaned down and taken his wine bottle, poured it out and said, "You don't understand. You're going to stop drinking now. You're going to be with me. You're going to help me. I need you, and I'm going to help you." Then Elay had held out her hand, Hawken had taken it, and they had walked away together. He had stopped drinking and entered into Elay's service. Elay had given him money to buy some clothes and to rent another apartment. He had done everything without wondering whether Elay was evil or good or anything else. Elay was beautiful, and Elay had given him back his dignity, and, in rare moments, tenderness. The pages rustled when the night guard turned them in the book she was reading, probably a dime store novel. In Plato's Republic, the guards were supposed to be the most highly educated among the people. But this was Sweden 1981, and they were probably reading Yon Gio. The man in the water, the man whose corpse he had sunk, that had been clumsy of him, of course. He should have done as Ile said and buried him. But nothing about the man would be traced back to Ile. The bite mark in his neck would be regarded as unusual, but they would think the blood had been washed away by the water. The man's clothes were... her top. Ile's top, the one Hawken had found on the man's body when he first came to take care of it. He should have taken it home with him, burned it, anything. Instead, he had tucked it inside the man's coat. How would they interpret that? A child's top spotted with blood. Was there a risk that someone had seen this shirt on Ile? Someone who would recognize it? If it was in the paper, for example. Someone Ile had met before. Someone who... Oscar. The boy next door. Hawken's body twisted restlessly in the bed. The guard put her book down and looked at him. Don't do anything stupid. Ile crossed Bjornsson's garden, continued into the courtyard between the nine-storied buildings, two monolithic lighthouses towering over the crouching three-story buildings scattered around. No one was outside, but there was light coming from the gymnasium, and Ile slithered up the fire escape ladder, looked in. Music was blaring out of a small tape player. Middle-aged women were jumping around in time to the music, so the wooden floor shook. Ile curled up in the metal grating of the stairs, leaned her chin on her knees, and took in the scene. Several of the women were overweight, and their massive breasts were bouncing like cheery bowling balls under their T-shirts. The women jumped and skipped, lifting their knees so the flesh trembled in their too-tight workout pants. They moved in a circle, clapped their hands, jumped again. All the while the music kept going, warm, oxygenated blood streaming through thirsty muscles. But there were too many of them. Ile jumped down from the fire escape, landed softly on the frozen ground underneath, continued around the back of the gym, and stopped outside the swimming pool. The large frosted windows projected rectangles of light onto the snow cover. Over each large window there was a smaller, narrow window made of regular glass. Ile jumped up and hung from the edge of the roof with her hands, looked in. No one was inside. The surface of the pool glittered in the glow of the halogen lights. A few balls were floating in the middle. Swim, splash, play. Ile swayed back and forth, a dark pendulum. Looked at the balls, saw them flying through the air, thrown up again, laughter and screams and splashing water. Ile relaxed her hold on the edge of the roof, fell down, and consciously let herself land so hard that it hurt, then kept going across the schoolyard to the path through the park, stopping under a high tree hanging over the path. It was dark, no one around. Ile looked up to the top of the tree, along 5 meters of smooth tree trunk, kicked off her shoes, thought herself new hands, new feet. It hardly hurt at all any more, just felt like a tingling, an electric current through her fingers and toes as they thinned out, took on a new shape. The bones crackled in her hands as they stretched out, shot out through the melting skin of the fingertips and made long, curved claws. Same thing with her toes. Ile jumped a couple of meters up onto the trunk of the tree, dug in her claws, and climbed up to a thick branch that hung out over the path, curled the claws on her feet around the branch, and sat without moving. A shooting sensation in her teeth, as Ile thought them sharp. The enamel bulged out, was sharpened by an invisible file, became sharp. Ile carefully bit her lower lip, a crescent-shaped row of needles that almost punctured the skin. Now only the weight. It was close to 10, and the temperature in the room was approaching the unbearable. 2 bottles of vodka had already been consumed, a new one had been taken out, and everyone agreed that Eustace was one hell of a guy, and his kindness wouldn't count for nothing. Only Virginia had been taking it easy, since she had to get up and work the next day. She also seemed to be the only one who was affected by the air in the room. The damp smell of cat piss and stale air was now mixed with smoke, alcohol fumes, and the perspiration of six bodies. Laka and Eusta were still sitting on either side of her on the couch, now only half-conscious. Eusta was petting a cat on his lap, a cat who was wall-eyed, something which had caused Morgan to have such fits of laughter that he had hit his head on the table and then had a shot of pure alcohol in order to dull the pain. Laka wasn't saying much. He mostly sat staring straight ahead, his eyes glazed over with haziness, then mist and fog. His lips moved soundlessly from time to time, as if he was conversing with a ghost. Virginia got up and walked over to the window.
"Is it okay if I open this?"
Eustace shook his head.
"The cats can jump out. But I'll stand here and keep watch."
Eustace kept shaking his head mechanically, and Virginia opened the window.
"Air."
She greedily took a couple of lungfuls of fresh air and immediately felt better. Laka, who had been starting to slip sideways on the couch since Virginia's support was no longer available, straightened up and said out loud,
"A friend! A real friend!"
A mumble of agreement from around the room. Everyone knew he was talking about Yucca. Laka stared into the empty glass in his hand and continued.
"You have one friend who never lets you down, and that is worth everything. Do you hear that? Everything. And you have to get that me and Yucca were like this."
He made his hand into a tight fist, shook it in front of his face.
"And nothing can replace that. Nothing. You're all sitting here yammering about what a damn good guy and all that, but you're all empty, hollow. I have nothing now that Yucca is gone. Nothing. So don't talk about loss with me. Don't talk about..."
Virginia stood next to the window, listening. She walked up to Laka in order to remind him of her existence, crouched down next to his knee and tried to catch his eye, and said,
"Laka." "No, don't come here and Laka, Laka. This is just the way it is. You don't get it. You're cold. You go downtown and pick up some damn truck driver or whatever, take him home and let him screw you when you get down. That's what you do. Damn trucking caravan is what you have going on. But a friend, a friend."
Virginia stood up with tears in her eyes, slapped Laka, and ran out of the apartment. Laka lost his balance on the couch and hit Eustace in the shoulder. Eustace mumbled,
"The window, the window."
Morgan closed it and said,
"Well done, Laka, that was a good one. You probably won't see any more of her."
Laka stood up and walked with unsteady legs over to Morgan, who cast an eye out the window.
"What the hell? I didn't mean to..." "No, of course not. Go tell her instead."
Morgan nodded down at the ground where Virginia had just come out of the front door of the building. She was walking rapidly towards the park, her gaze lowered. Laka heard what he had said. His last words to her stuck inside his head like an echo.
"Did I say that?"
He turned on his heel and hurried to the door.
"I just have to..."
Morgan nodded.
"Hurry up and give her my regards."
Laka threw himself down the stairs as fast as his trembling legs could carry him. The speckled pattern stairs were nothing but a shimmer before his eyes, and the banister slid so quickly through his hand it started to sting from the friction. He tripped on a landing, fell, and hit his elbow hard. The arm filled with heat and became sort of paralyzed. He got up and stumbled on down the stairs. He was rushing to help save a life. His own. Virginia walked away from the building, down to the park, and did not turn around. Her body was racked with sobs, half running as if to outrun the tears. But they followed her, forced themselves into her eyes, and fell in big drops down her cheeks. Her heels cut through the snow, clicking against the asphalt of the path, and she wound her arms around herself, hugging herself. There was no one to be seen, so she gave in freely to her sobs as she made her way home, pressed her arms against her stomach, the pain lodged in there like an ill-tempered fetus. Let a person in and he hurts you. There was a reason why she kept her relationships brief. Don't let them in. Once they're inside, they have more potential to hurt you. Comfort yourself. You can live with the anguish as long as it only involves yourself, as long as there is no hope. But with Laka, she had held out hope that something would slowly grow up between them. And in the end, one day, what? He accepted her food and her warmth, but in reality she meant nothing to him. She walked huddled up along the path, doubled over with sorrow. Her back stooped, and it was as if a demon sat there whispering terrible things in her ear. Never again. Nothing. Just as she was starting to imagine what this demon looked like, it landed on top of her. A heavy weight struck her in the back, and she fell helplessly to the side. Her cheek met snow, and the film of tears was transformed into ice. The weight remained. For one second, she really believed it was the sorrow demon who had taken a physical form and thrown itself on top of her. Then she felt the searing pain in her throat as sharp teeth penetrated the skin. She managed to get back on her feet, spinning around and trying to get rid of the thing that was on top of her. There was something chewing on her neck, her throat. A stream of blood ran down between her breasts. She screamed at the top of her lungs and tried to shake off the creature on her back, kept screaming as she fell again onto the snow, until something hard was laid over her mouth. A hand. Against her cheek, there were claws digging into the soft flesh, all the way in until they reached the cheekbone. The teeth stopped chewing, and she heard a sound like the one you make with a straw as you suck up the dregs in the glass. Liquid flowed over one eye, and she didn't know if it was tears or blood. When Laka came out of the apartment building, Virginia was nothing more than a dark shape moving down the path towards Arvid Mernis. His chest was hurting from sprinting down the stairs, and his elbow sent waves of pain towards the shoulder. In spite of all this, he ran. He ran as fast as he could. His head was starting to clear in the cool air, and fear of losing her drove him on. When he reached the bend in the path where Yocca's path, as he had started to call it, met Virginia's path, he stopped, drew as much air into his lungs as he could to shout out her name. She was up ahead, only 50 meters away. Just as he was about to call out her name, he saw a shadow fall from a tree above Virginia, land on her, and knock her to the ground. His scream turned into a hiss, and he sped up. He wanted to shout something, but there was not enough air to both run and shout. He ran. In front of him, Virginia got to her feet with a large lump on her back, spun around like a crazed hunchback, and fell down again. He had no plan, no thoughts, nothing except this: to get to Virginia and get rid of whatever that was on her back. She lay in the snow next to the path with that black mass crawling on her. When he reached her, he directed all of his force into a kick at the black thing. His foot made contact with something hard, and he heard a sharp crack, as when ice breaks up. The black thing was thrown from Virginia's back and landed in the snow next to her. Virginia lay completely still. There were dark stains on the white ground. The black thing sat up. A child. Laka stood there, staring into the prettiest little child's face imaginable, framed by a veil of black hair. A pair of enormous dark eyes met his. The child got up on all fours, cat-like, preparing to lunge. The face changed as the child drew back its lips, and Laka could see the rows of sharp teeth glow in the dark. They remained like this for a few panting breaths. The child on all fours, and Laka could now see that its fingers were claws, sharply defined against the snow. Then a grimace of pain contorted the child's face. She got up on two legs and ran off in the direction of the school with long, rapid steps. A few seconds later, she reached the shadows and was gone. Laka stood where he was and blinked away the sweat running into his eyes. Then he threw himself down next to Virginia. He saw the wound. Her whole throat was ripped up. Dark strands of blood ran all the way up into her hair, down her back. He stripped off his jacket, pulled off the sweater he was wearing underneath, bunched it up into a ball, and pressed it against the wound.
"Virginia! Virginia! My darling, beloved!"
At last he was able to get the words out. Saturday, the 7th of November. On his way to Dad's house. Every bend in the road familiar. He had taken this route how many times? Alone, maybe only 10 or 12. With his mum, maybe another 30 at least. His mum and dad had divorced when he was 4, but Oscar and his mum had kept coming out on weekends and holidays. The last 3 years he had been allowed to take the bus by himself. This time his mum hadn't even come with him into the Tekniska Herkskollen stop where the buses left. He was a big boy now, had his own book of prepaid tickets to the subway in his wallet. Actually, the main reason he had the wallet was to have a place to keep the prepaid tickets, but now there was also 20 kroner to buy sweets and such, as well as the notes from Ile. Oscar fiddled with the band-aid on his palm. He didn't want to see her any more. She was scary. What happened in the basement was... she showed her true face. There was something in her, something that was... pure horror. Everything you were supposed to watch out for. Heights, fire, shards of glass, snakes, everything that his mum tried so hard to keep him safe from. Maybe that was why he hadn't wanted Ile and his mum to meet. His mum would have recognised it, forbidden him to get near it. Near Ile. The bus exited the freeway and turned down towards Spilishboda. This was the only bus that went to Rodmansur Island. That was why it had to wind its way up and down all the roads in order to drive through as many settlements as possible. The bus drove past the mountainous landscape of piled timber at the Spilishboda sawmill, made a sharp turn, and almost slid on its back down towards the pier. He had not waited for Ile on Friday evening. Instead, he had taken the snow racer and gone by himself to Ghost Hill. His mum had protested, since he had stayed home from school that day with a cold, but he said he felt better. He walked through China Park with the snow racer on his back. The sledding hill started 100 metres past the last park lights, 100 metres of dark forest. The snow crunched under his feet. There was a soft soughing from the forest, like breathing. The moonlight filtered through the trees, and the ground between them turned into a woven tapestry of shadows, where figures without faces waited, swaying to and fro. He reached the place where the path started to bear down strongly towards Gavarnvilken Bay, and climbed onto his snow racer. The ghost house was a black wall next to the hill, a reprimand. "You are not allowed to be here in the dark. This is our place now. If you want to play here, you'll have to play with us." At the bottom of the hill, you could see the occasional light shining from the Kvarnvilken Boat Club. Oscar inched himself forward, the incline took over, and the snow racer started to glide. He squeezed the steering wheel, wanted to close his eyes, but didn't dare to, because then he might veer off the road and down the steep slope towards the ghost house. He shot down the hill, a projectile of nerves and tensed muscles. Faster, faster. Formless, snow-covered arms stretched out from the ghost house, grabbing for his hat, brushing against his cheek. Maybe it was only a sudden gust of wind, but at the very bottom of the hill he drove into a viscous, transparent, filmy barrier stretched out over the path that tried to stop him. But his speed was too great. The snow racer drove into the filmy barrier, and it was glued onto his face and body, was stretched until it burst, and then he was through. The lights were glittering over Kvarnvilken Bay. He sat and stared out over the spot where he had knocked down Johnny yesterday morning. Turned around. The ghost house was an ugly shack of sheet metal. He pulled the snow racer up the hill again, slid down. Up again, down again. Couldn't stop. And he went on. Went on until his face was a mask of ice. Then he walked home. He had only slept 4 or 5 hours, afraid that Elay was going to come, of what he would be forced to say, to do, if she did that. Push her away. And so he fell asleep on the bus to Norrtälje, and didn't wake up until they were there. On the Rådmansur bus, he had kept himself awake, made a game out of trying to remember as much as possible along the way. Soon there will be a yellow house with a windmill on the lawn. A yellow house with a snowy windmill on the lawn passed by outside the window. And so on. In Spillersboda, a girl got on the bus. Oscar gripped the back of the seat in front of him. She looked a little like Elay. Of course it wasn't her. The girl sat down a few seats in front of him. He looked at her neck. What's wrong with her? The thought had come to him even as he was in the cellar gathering the bottles together and wiping the blood away with a piece of cloth from the garbage. Elay was a vampire. That explained a lot of things. That she was never out in the daytime. That she could see in the dark, which he had come to understand she could. Plus a lot of other things. The way she talked, the cube, her flexibility, things that of course could have a natural explanation. But then there was also the way that she had licked his blood from the floor, and what really made him shiver was when he thought about the, can I come in, say that I can come in. That she had needed an invitation to come into his room, to his bed, and he had invited her in, a vampire. A being that lived off other people's blood. Elay. There was not one person who he could tell. No one would believe him. And if someone did believe him, what would happen? Oscar imagined a caravan of men walking through Blackaberry, in through the covered entrance where he and Elay had hugged, with sharpened stakes in their hands. He was afraid of Elay now, didn't want to see her any more. But he didn't want that. 3/4 of an hour after he had boarded the bus in Norrtälje, he arrived in Sudersvilk. He pulled on the string, and the bell rang up front by the driver. The bus pulled over right in front of the store, and he had to wait for an old lady, whom he recognized but didn't know the name of, to get off. His dad was standing below the stairs, nodded and said, to the old lady. Oscar climbed off the bus, stood still for a second in front of his dad. This last week, things had happened that had made Oscar feel bigger. Not adult, but bigger at any rate. All that fell away as he stood in front of his father. His mum claimed his dad was childlike, in a bad way. Immature, couldn't handle responsibility. Oh, she said some nice things about him too, but that was what she always came back to, the immaturity. For Oscar, his dad was the very image of an adult, as he now stretched out his broad arms and Oscar fell into them. His dad smelled different from all the people in the city. In his torn Helly Hansen vest fixed with Velcro, there was always the same mixture of wood, paint, metal, and above all, oil. These were the smells, but Oscar didn't think of them in that way. It was all simply dad smell. He loved it, and drew a deep breath through his nose as he pressed his face against his dad's chest.
Well, hey there.
Hi, Dad.
Your trip go okay?
No, we ran into an elk.
Oh, no, that must have been something.
Just joking.
I see. But, you know, I remember a time.
As they walked towards the store, Dad started telling a story about how once a truck he was driving had collided with an elk. Oscar had heard the story before and looked around, humming from time to time. The Sudersvilk store looked as trashy as ever. Signs and streamers that had been allowed to stay up in anticipation of next summer made the whole store look like an oversized ice cream stand. The large tent behind the store, where they sold garden tools, soil, outdoor furniture and such, was tied up for the season. In summer, the population of Sudersvilk increased fourfold. The whole area down towards Norrtäljevilken Bay, Lågera, was an unruly conglomeration of summer houses, and even though the mailboxes down towards Lågera were hung in double rows of 30, the postman almost never had to go there at this time of year. No people, no mail. Just as they reached the moped, his dad finished the story with the elk. "And then I had to hit him with a crowbar that I had for opening drawers and that kind of thing, right between the eyes. He twitched like this and, yes, no, it wasn't so nice."
"No, of course not."
Oscar jumped up on the trailer, pulling his legs in under him. His dad dug around in a pocket on the vest and pulled out a cap.
"Here, it'll get cold around your ears."
"No, I have one."
Oscar took out his own cap and put it on. Dad put the other one away.
"What about you? It'll get cold around your ears."
Dad laughed. "No, I'm used to it." Of course, Oscar knew that. He was just teasing. He couldn't remember ever seeing his dad in a wool cap. If it got really cold and windy, he put on a kind of bearskin hat with ear flaps that he called his inheritance, but that was the limit. His dad kick-started the moped, and it roared like an electric chainsaw. He shouted something about the idling and put it in first. The moped jumped forward, almost causing Oscar to fall backwards. His dad yelled something about the gears, and then they were off. Second, third gear. The moped flew through the town. Oscar sat with his legs crossed in the clattering trailer. He felt like the king of the world, and would have been able to keep going like this forever. A physician had explained it to him. The fumes he had inhaled had burned away his vocal cords, and he would probably never be able to speak normally again. A new operation would give him a rudimentary ability to produce vowels, but since even his tongue and lips were badly injured, there would have to be additional operations to enable the possibility of uttering consonants. As a former Swedish teacher, Håkan could not help but be fascinated at the thought. To create speech by surgical means. He knew quite a bit about phonemes, the smallest components of language, common across many cultures. He had never reflected much over the actual tools of production, the roof of the mouth, lips, tongue, vocal cords, in this way. To coax speech from this shapeless raw material with a scalpel. But it was meaningless anyway. He did not intend to speak. In addition, he suspected that the doctor was talking that way for a special reason. He was considered suicide-prone. Therefore, it was important to imprint him with a linear sense of time, to recreate the feeling of life as a project, a dream of future conquests. He didn't buy it. If Elay needed him, he could consider living. Otherwise, he could not. Nothing indicated that Elay needed him. But how would Elay be able to contact him in this place? From the treetops outside his window, he sensed that he was high up, and furthermore, he was well guarded. In addition to the doctors and nurses, there was always at least one policeman nearby. Elay could not reach him, and he could not reach Elay. The thought of escaping, of getting in touch with Elay one last time, had gone through his head, but how? The throat operation had made him capable of breathing on his own again. He no longer had to be attached to a respirator. But he could not get food down in the normal way. Even this would be repaired, the doctor had assured him. The feeding tube dangled constantly at the edge of his vision. If he pulled it out, an alarm would go off somewhere. And anyway, he saw very badly. To escape was basically unthinkable. A plastic surgeon had taken the opportunity to transplant a piece of skin from his back to his eyelid so he could shut his eye. He shut his eye. The door to his room opened. It was time again. He recognized the voice, the same man as before.
"Well, well," said the man. "They tell me there won't be any talking in the near future. That's too bad. But I have this stubborn thought that we could still manage to communicate with each other, you and me, if you're up for it."
Hawken tried to remember what Plato said in The Republic about murderers and violent offenders, what you were supposed to do with them.
"I see you can shut your eye now. That's good. You know what? I'll try to make this a little more concrete for you, because it struck me that maybe you don't believe we're going to identify you. But we will. I'm sure you remember you had a wristwatch. Luckily, it was an older watch with the manufacturer's initials, serial number and everything. We're going to trace it within a couple of days, in one way or another. A week, maybe. And there are other things. We'll find you. That's a certainty. So, Max. I don't know why I want to call you Max. It is entirely provisional. Max, maybe you want to help us out a little here. Otherwise, we'll have to take a picture of you and send it to the papers and, well, you see, it will be complicated. Much easier if you talk, or something, with me now. You had a piece of paper with the Morse code in your pocket. Do you know the Morse code? Because in that case, we can talk by tapping. Hawken opened his eye, looked in the direction of the two dark spots in the white, blurry oval that was the man's face. The man clearly chose to interpret this as an invitation. He continued. "This man in the water, it wasn't you who killed him, was it? The pathologists say that the bite marks on his neck were probably made by a child. And now we've had a report that I unfortunately can't give any details of, but I think you are protecting someone. Is this correct? Lift your hand if this is correct." Hawken shut his eye. The policeman sighed. "Okay, then we'll let the machine keep working. Is there anything else you would like to tell me before I go?" The man was about to get up when Hawken lifted his hand. The policeman sat down again. Hawken lifted the hand higher and waved. "Goodbye." The policeman let out a snorting sound, got up and left. Virginia's injuries had not been life-threatening. On Friday afternoon, she was discharged from the hospital with 14 stitches and a large bandage on her neck, a smaller one on her cheek. She had refused Laka's offer to stay with her, live with her until she felt better. She had gone to bed Friday evening, convinced that she would get up and go to work Saturday morning. Couldn't afford to stay home. It had been hard to fall asleep. Memories of the attack kept returning, and she couldn't get settled. Thought she saw black lumps emerge out of the shadows of her room and fall down on her as she lay in bed with her eyes wide open. The wound on her throat itched under the bandage. Around 2 o'clock in the morning, she got hungry, went out into the kitchen and opened the refrigerator. Her stomach had felt empty, but as she stood there and looked at all the food, there was nothing she wanted. From habit, she had still taken out the bread, butter, cheese and milk and set them on the kitchen table. She made herself a cheese sandwich and poured milk into a glass. Then she sat at the table and looked at the white liquid in the glass, the brown piece of bread with its yellow slice of cheese. It looked revolting. She didn't want it. She threw it out, pouring the milk into the sink. There was a half-full bottle of white wine in the fridge. She poured out a glass, brought it to her lips, but when she smelled the wine, she lost interest. With a feeling of failure, she poured herself a glass of water from the tap. She hesitated. Surely you could always drink water? Yes, she could drink the water, but it tasted stale, as if everything good in the water had been removed and only left the flat dregs. She went back to bed, shifting restlessly for a few more hours, then finally falling asleep. When she woke up, it was 10:30. She threw herself out of bed, pulled on some clothes in the dim bedroom. Good heavens,
She should have been at the store at 8. Why hadn't they called? Oh, but wait. She had heard the phone ring. It had rung in her last dream before she woke up, then stopped. If they hadn't called, she would still be sleeping. She buttoned her blouse and walked over to the window, pulled up the blinds. The light struck her face like a physical blow. She staggered back, away from the window, and dropped the cords to the blinds. They slipped down again with a clattering sound, stopping at a crooked angle. She sat down on the bed. A single beam of sunlight came in through the window, shining on her naked foot. 1,000 pinpricks, as if her skin were being twisted in two directions at once. What is this? She moved her foot away, pulled on her socks, moved her foot back into the sunlight. Better. Only 100 pinpricks. She stood up to go to work, then sat down again. Some kind of shock? The sensation when she pulled up the blinds had been ghastly, as if the light were heavy matter flung at her body, pushing her away. It had been the worst in the eyes. Two strong thumbs pressing on them, threatening to gouge them out of her head. They were still stinging. She rubbed her eyes with the palms of her hands, took her sunglasses out of the bathroom cabinet and put them on. Hunger raged in her body, but all she had to do was think of the refrigerator and pantry contents to make all thoughts of eating breakfast disappear. And anyway, she had no time. She was almost 3 hours late. She went out, locked the door, and walked down the stairs as fast as she could. Her body was weak. Maybe it was a mistake to go to work today. Well, the store would only be open 4 more hours, and it was now the Saturday customers started to come in. She was so preoccupied with these thoughts that she did not hesitate before opening the front door of the building. The light was there again. Her eyes hurt, despite the sunglasses. Boiling water was poured over her hands and face. She gave a little scream, pulled her hands into her coat, bent her face to the ground, and ran. She could not protect her neck and scalp, and they stung like they were on fire. Luckily, it was not far to the store. When she was safely inside, the stinging and pain eased. Most of the store windows were covered in advertising and protective plastic film so that the sunlight wouldn't affect the goods. She took off her glasses. It hurt a little, but that could be because some sunlight came in the spaces between the advertising posters. She put her sunglasses in her pocket and walked to the office. Lennart, the store manager and her boss, was there filling out forms, but he looked up when she came in. She had expected some kind of reprimand, but he simply said, "Hi, how's it going?"
"Oh, fine."
"Shouldn't you be at home getting some rest?"
"No, I thought..."
"You didn't need to, you know. Lotten will fill in for you today. I tried to call you earlier, but when you didn't pick up..."
"Isn't there anything for me to do, then?"
"Check with Berit in the meat department. And Virginia..."
"Yes?"
"I'm sorry about what happened. I don't know exactly how to say it, but I feel badly about it. And I completely understand if you need to take it easy for a while." Virginia couldn't get her head around it. Lennart was not the type of person who looked kindly on sick leave, or, for that matter, any problem that other people might have. And to hear him extend his personal sympathies was something completely new. She must look pretty terrible with her swollen cheek and her bandages.
"Thanks," Virginia said. "I'll think it over,"
and went to the meat department. She looped over past the checkout registers to say hi to Lotten. 5 people were lined up at her register, and Virginia thought she should open another one after all. But the question was if Lennart even wanted her to sit at a checkout register looking as she did. When she walked into the light from the horrible window behind the registers, it got like that again. Her face tightened, her eyes ached. It wasn't as bad as the direct sunlight out on the street, but it was bad enough. She would not be able to sit there. Lotten caught sight of her, waved in between 2 customers.
"Hi, Eired. How are you doing?"
Virginia held up her hand, wiggled it from side to side, so-so. Red? She nabbed the Svenska Dagbladet and Dagens Nyheter, took them with her over to the meat department, quickly eyed the front pages. Nothing there. That would have been a stretch. The meat department was at the very back of the store, beside the milk products, strategically planned so that you had to walk through the whole store to get there. Virginia stopped next to the shelves with canned food. She was trembling with hunger. She looked carefully at all the cans. Crushed tomatoes, mushrooms, mussels, tuna, ravioli, Bullen's beer sausage, pea soup. No, she felt nothing but revulsion. Berit saw her from the meat counter, waved. As soon as Virginia had come around the back of the counter, Berit hugged her and carefully touched the bandage on her cheek. Ah, oh, poor you. Oh, it's fine. She retreated to the little storage room behind the meat counter. If she let Berit get started, she would be subject to a long harangue about people's suffering in general and the evils of today's society in particular. Virginia sat down on a chair between the scales and the door to the freezer room. It was an area of only a few square meters, but it was the most comfortable place in the store. No sunlight. She flipped through the papers and found a small article in the Dagens Nyheter domestic news section. She read, "Woman Attacked in Blackaberry." A 50-year-old woman was attacked and assaulted Thursday night in the Stockholm suburb of Blackaberry. A passerby intervened, and the perpetrator, a young woman, immediately fled the scene. The motive of the assault is unknown. The police are now investigating a possible connection to other violent incidents in the western suburbs during the past few weeks. The 50-year-old woman's injuries were described as minor. Virginia lowered the paper. So strange to read about yourself in that way. 50-year-old woman, passerby, minor injuries. Everything that was concealed by those words. Possible connection. Yes. Lacka was convinced that she had been attacked by the same child who killed Jukka. He had had to bite his tongue not to say this at the hospital to the female police officer and the doctor who examined her early on Friday morning. He was planning to talk to the police, but wanted to inform Justa first, thought Justa would see the whole thing from a new perspective now that even Virginia had been involved. She heard a rustling sound and looked around. It took a few seconds before she realized that it was the newspaper shaking in her own hands that was making the noise. She set the papers on the shelf above the white coats and went out to join Berit.
"Anything I can do?"
"Do you really think it's a good idea, hun?"
"Yes. It's better for me to be doing something."
"I see. You can portion out the shrimp in that case. 500-gram bags. But shouldn't you..." Virginia shook her head and walked back to the storage room. She put on a white coat and hat, took a case of shrimp out of the freezer, pulled a plastic bag over her hand, and started to weigh them out. Dug around in the carton with the hand that had the plastic bag over it, portioned them out into bags, weighed them on the scales. A boring, mechanical job, and her right hand felt frozen already on her fourth bag. But she was doing something, and it gave her an opportunity to think. At the hospital, Lacka had said something really strange, that the child who attacked her had not been a human being, that it had fangs and claws. Virginia had dismissed this as a drunken hallucination. She didn't remember much from the attack, but she could accept this. The thing that had jumped on top of her had been much too light to be an adult. Almost too light to be a child, even. A very small child, in that case. 5 or 6, maybe. She recalled that she had stood up with the weight on her back. After that, everything was black until she woke up in her apartment with all the guys except Justa gathered around her. She put a tie around a finished bag, took out the next one, dropped in a few handfuls. 430 grams. 7 more shrimp. 510. Our treat. She looked down at her hands that were working independently of her brain. Hands with long nails, sharp teeth. What was that called? Lacquer had said it out loud. A vampire. Virginia had laughed carefully so that the stitches in her cheek wouldn't come out. Lacquer had not even smiled.
You didn't see it.
But Lacquer, they don't really exist.
No, but what was it then?
A child living out a strange twisted fantasy.
Who grew out her nails, filed her teeth down? I'd like to see the dentist who...
Lacquer, it was dark. You were drunk.
It was, and I was, but I saw what I saw.
It burned and felt tight under the bandage on her cheek. She removed the plastic bag from her right hand, put her hand over the bandage. It was ice cold, and that felt good. But she was weak. It felt as if her legs weren't going to carry her much longer. She would finish this carton and then go home. This wasn't going to work. If she could rest over the weekend, she would probably feel better on Monday. She put the plastic bag back on and started in on the work again with a spark of anger. Hated being sick. A sharp pain in her index finger. Damn it. That's what happens if you don't concentrate. The shrimp were sharp when they were frozen, and she had pricked her finger. She pulled off the plastic bag and looked at the finger. A smallish cut with a little blood welling out of it. She automatically popped it into her mouth to suck the blood away. A warm, healing, delicious spot radiating out from the place where her fingertip met her tongue started to spread. She sucked harder on the finger. All good tastes concentrated into one filled her mouth. A shiver of well-being went through her body. She sucked and sucked, giving in to the pleasure, until she realized what she was doing. She pulled the finger out of her mouth, stared at it. It was shiny with saliva, and the tiny amount of blood that now welled out was immediately thinned out by the wetness, like an overly diluted watercolor. She looked at the shrimp in the carton. Hundreds of pink bodies covered with frost. And eyes. Black pinheads dispersed in the white and pink, an upside-down starry sky. Patterns, constellations started to dance in front of her eyes. The world spun on its axis, and something hit her in the back of the head. In front of her eyes there was a white surface with cobwebs in the corners. She understood that she was lying on the floor, but had no strength to do anything about it. In the distance, she heard Birrit's voice.
"Oh, my God! Virginia!"
Johnny liked to hang out with his older brother, at least when none of his sketchy buddies were around. Jimmy knew some guys from Rockstar that Johnny was pretty scared of. One evening a few years ago, they had come by to talk to Jimmy, hanging around outside, but without ringing the buzzer. When Johnny told them Jimmy wasn't home, they asked him to deliver a message.
"Tell your brother that if he doesn't get us the dough by Monday, we'll put his head in a vice. You know what that is? Okay. And turn it, like this, until the dough runs out of his ears, like this. Can you tell him that?"
"Okay, great. Johnny's your name?"
"Goodbye then, Johnny."
Johnny had delivered the message, and Jimmy had simply nodded, said he knew. Then some money had disappeared from Mum's wallet, and then there had been an angry scene. Jimmy was not home as often nowadays. There was no real room for him any more, since their youngest little sister was born. Johnny already had two younger siblings, and there weren't supposed to be any more. But then Mum had met some guy and, well, that's how it went. At least Johnny and Jimmy had the same dad. He worked on an oil rig off the coast of Norway, and not only had he started sending regular child support, he was also sending a little extra just to make up for before. Mum blessed him, and when she was drunk, she had even cried over him a few times and said she would never again meet a man like that. So, for the first time in as long as Johnny could remember, a lack of money was not the constant topic of conversation.
Now they were sitting in the pizzeria on the main square in Blackberry. Jimmy had been home in the morning, argued a bit with Mum, and then he and Johnny had gone out. Jimmy heaped condiments on his pizza, folded it up, picked up the large roll with both hands, and started to eat. Johnny ate his pizza in the usual way, thinking that next time he ate pizza without Jimmy, he would eat it like that. Jimmy chewed, nodded his head at the bandage over Johnny's ear.
"Looks like hell."
"Yes."
"Does it hurt?"
"It's okay."
"Mum said it's damaged for life, that you won't be able to hear anything."
"They don't know yet. Maybe it'll be all right."
"Hmm. Let me get this straight. The guy just picked up some big branch and bashed it into your head."
"Hmm."
"Damn. What are you going to do about it?"
"Don't know."
"Need any help?"
"No."
"What? Me and a few of my pals can take him out."
Johnny pulled off a big piece with shrimp, his favourite, put it in his mouth and chewed. No, not drag Jimmy's friends into this, then it would get out of hand. Nonetheless, Johnny smiled at the thought of how scared shitless Oscar would be if he appeared at his house with Jimmy and, say, those guys from Rockstar. He shook his head. Jimmy put his pizza roll down and looked seriously at Johnny.
"Okay, but I'm just saying, one more thing and then..."
He snapped his fingers hard and made a fist.
"You're my brother, and no little shit is going to come and..." "One more thing, then you can say whatever you like. Then I'm going after him, okay?"
Jimmy held out his fist across the table. Johnny also made a fist and bumped Jimmy's with it. It felt good that there was someone who cared. Jimmy nodded.
"Good. I have something for you."
He bent down under the table, took out a plastic bag that he had been carrying all morning. He drew a thin photo album out of the bag.
"Dad came by last week. He's grown a beard, almost didn't recognise him. He had this with him."
Jimmy held the album out to Johnny, who wiped his fingers on a napkin and opened it. Pictures of children, of Mum, maybe 10 years ago, and a man he recognised as his father. The man was pushing the kids on swings. In one picture, he was wearing a much too small cowboy hat. Jimmy, maybe 9 years old, was standing next to him with a plastic rifle in his hands and a grim expression. A little boy who had to be Johnny sat on the ground nearby and looked wide-eyed at them.
"He loaned me this till next time. He wants it back, said it was..." "Yeah, what the fuck was it?" "My most valuable possession, I think he said. Thought it might interest you too."
Johnny nodded without looking up from the album. He had only met his dad 2 times since he left when Johnny was 4. At home there was one picture of him, a pretty bad one where he was sitting around with some other people. This was something completely different. Here you could construct a real image of him.
"One more thing. Don't show it to Mum. I think Dad kind of swiped it when he left, and if she sees it... Well, he wants it back, as I told you. Promise, don't show Mum."
Still with his nose buried in the album,